Okay, meeting will come to order. This is Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs today on February 16th. First, we'll do the approval of the minutes of the February 8th meeting. Mm-hmm. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After reviewing the minutes, I'd like to move for the approval.
Thank you, Representative Hosh. Moves approval of the minutes of the February 8th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and minutes are approved. Thank you. Members, thank you for coming during our last interim meeting here. We'll be hearing from staff from the Military Affairs, Veterans Affairs Office, and Department of Administration. And we're hoping to be done today approximately 11:45. It may run a little bit later, so please bear with us. I'd like to make note of the bottom of your agenda listing the upcoming meetings, which will occur when we get back in session on March 1st. As you know, our regular meeting time is from 10:15 to noon, but the first day that we come back, session is at noon, so we actually will not meet in the morning of that first day, but we will meet immediately after session adjourns. We have up to three bills we'd like to move through committee that day. I think maybe two of them we heard in last week's meeting. And so as soon as we have the information on that, we'll get it out to you and watch the website. But we expect that meeting on Wednesday, March 1st, to go from about 12:45 till maybe 2:15. So if you do have a 2:30 committee meeting, we should be done by then. So watch for more details. And then on the second day of session, Thursday, March 2nd, we'll meet during our regular committee time in the morning from 10:15 to noon, where we'll take up the report of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund Advisory Task Force. And many of you remember from last session there was a discussion about legislative reform on the LCMR, the commission that does the funding from the Environmental Trust Fund from the lottery proceeds, which I understand with what's going on with the scratch-offs that we might get some more money in that fund here in the next week or so. But so we'll have that report from that interim task force that met, which will then be followed by the bill that supports the work of the task force. And I was an ex-officio member of that commission, so I'll be presenting that bill. And then I'd like to make note, members, on that second day of session, March 2nd, we'll continue that hearing after 3 o'clock session. We don't know at this point how much public testimony there will be on that bill to reform that commission. And I know Representative Phyllis Kahn served as a member of that commission. And as you know, she's the lead DFL on our committee here. So please get that time set aside on your calendars. So the afternoon of the March 1st and the morning and the afternoon of March 2nd. We're potentially looking at a Friday morning meeting on March 3rd. And then, as you know, we have a short break for precinct caucuses and then come back the following Wednesday. So we'll get you a March calendar of all the dates. In fact, we're looking at additional evening meetings, probably Tuesday, Thursday, especially later in the month as bills move through committees and we get the second and third referrals to our committees. So please watch for that information and appreciate your consideration of that. So with that, we'd like to get started with a presentation from the Department of Military Affairs, the Adjutant General, Larry Shelato. And I know that you've been very, very busy, General Shelato, with what's going on with our deployed troops. So we're looking forward to your update here.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Welcome.
For those of the committee and so forth, but more or less those in the on the sides, we'll be using the audio-visual equipment quite extensively in this first presentation, so if you want to position yourself to see that, that would be great. What I'd like to be able to do is start out, I have a prepared presentation, and after that we'll like then open it up to questions. We'd like to start out with a video, and then from that video I'm going to give you a general overview of what the Guard has been doing, and then again, with your questions toward the end. And I think my intent here is twofold. One is to make the committee aware that times have changed for the Minnesota National Guard, so whatever preconceived notions you had of the National Guard, we will dispel them. And also then we will focus heavily on our integration and partnering with the Department of Veterans Affairs in moving forward to taking care of our soldiers, because right now the Minnesota National Guard is the largest producer of veterans in the state of Minnesota. I'll explain how that's been happening. And then in turn, we're going to give you a foretaste, if you will, of things that we would hope to achieve from the legislature this session. And I'm just one of three in the three parts. At first, we'd like to just show a general video that we do just as a warm-up, if you will. With me is Lieutenant Savage. Those of you that have this, you are the first to receive the legislatively required annual report from the Minnesota National Guard to the governor and to the legislature. This is it. We hired a professional firm to do this. It's called Lieutenant Sherry Savage. This is her love and devotion and her talents, and all done in-house, and we're very, very proud of that. Sherry?
Congratulations. Welcome to the committee.
The mobilization of Minnesota National Guard soldiers has become almost routine.
That's the why. The why is these individuals have to be stopped. And as you know, throughout history, there are times when push comes to shove.
Wow, that was very sobering. Beautiful video.
The agenda that we have is for today is we're going to do a very brief overview of the state mission, our federal mission. But I'd like you to take a look at the last three bullets. Other than the questions, I want to focus the majority of our time, because this is the issues that are going to impact this group here, and that's our family support initiatives and our reintegration efforts. First of all, on the state mission, what I think all of you know this, but I just want to reemphasize it. Of all the military components, active, guard, or reserve, Minnesota has close to 20,000 people, citizens in the reserve components, Army, Navy, Air, Marines. I think we even have detachments of Coast Guards. There is only one element, the National Guard, which consists of the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, that are under the control of the state. So if you ask why you need to be involved in military operations, which is normally considered to be federal, is because you are part owner. The Constitution said we will not have an imperial army. We will be diverse and we will be divided, and each state will maintain their own, and that's why we are here. What I'd like to do is just go over the organizations that we do have. At the Minneapolis Air Force Base, we have the 133rd Airlift Wing, and let me see the hands of those that have flown in a C-130. All right, it's working. Good job, Colonel Shields. But that same planes that you were flying in also have been deployed into 28 different countries since 9/11. Currently, they are in Ramstein, Germany, and they are flying back and forth doing support missions to the Balkans, i.e. Bosnia and Kosovo. Our fighter wing up in Duluth. Now, you shouldn't have been in an F-16 because there's only one seat. So unless you are a pilot, you are there. We do have some here in the audience. That's it. But most recently, in this past year, they have deployed to Iraq. They did their combat mission there. They're based out of Balad, and did excellent, excellent work. As you see here, they've been doing combat patrols, which you may not be aware of, and we don't talk about this a lot, but when President Bush was here, you probably didn't see them, but they were there in the air. A year ago, we scared the living daylights of a small Piper Cub, but the guy couldn't figure out why we were worried about him when he had, he said, I got 40 gallons of gas on each wing, you know. Well, 80 pounds of gas is kind of a nice explosive. But anyway, also, what you really didn't probably know is that for almost two-thirds of the Super Bowl, we were capping Detroit, Michigan. You know, just to be aware of that one, because that was a very high lucrative target. So they've been very active, and probably the most singular thing that happened this past year is the Duluth Air Guard survived what was called BRAC, Base Reduction and Consolidation, and that would have been about a $32 million economic impact annually to the city and area of the greater Duluth area. So we survived that. And it's based on a combination of things. But again, this is a unit that's always been, in all the Minnesota units, Army and Air, have been over 100%, and their performance and readiness ratings have been superior. Now, on the Army side, there's going to be three parts that I'm going to talk about. The first is the flagship of the Army, and that's the 34th Red Bull Division. This is what you'll hear and see a lot about. You have in the past year, but you've seen nothing until what's coming up in this next year, because we're going to be deploying 2,600 of those Red Bulls to Iraq, and they'll be leaving Camp Shelby in the middle of March, and they'll be in country, and we have a media package that is going. We've already had a number of requests for inputs and so forth, so you're going to see a lot of that. So you're going to get a lot of questions, and I hope to answer some of them or give you some of the most commonly asked questions up front here so that you can answer them. But also, we just received back, starting in the 1st of December, we received back over 1,000 who have been in Iraq for the past year. Most of those were in southwest Minnesota, in the Marshall and Morris areas, in particular, a unit out of Wadena. Also, we had a number that were in Afghanistan. So we are learning the lessons of those that are returning and the impact, and that's what we'll be asking you for support on, and that's our reintegration efforts. But in addition to the Red Bulls, we have our 34th or 84th Troop Command, and that's about 1,000 troops. They oftentimes are neglected because they don't wear that World War II famous Red Bull patch. But these are units that are created by the military to be available to. In fact, they are historically the most equipped and highest priority units. For example, Charlie, 142nd Engineers out of Camp Ripley, Minnesota, were the first to deploy into Iraq. They were there on basically the day one invasion component. That's how ready they had to be. But we've had our finance and our personnel and so forth, and that's being restructured as we speak. But it's going very, very well for that organization. And then we have Camp Ripley itself. Again, if you have not been to Camp Ripley, please take advantage of one of our opportunities to go down there. It is a jewel. It is truly a jewel. It's got 53,000 of the most pristine acres, just the recipient of a National Environmental Award. They won it once before, and then they had to wait 3 years before they could compete again, and they won it again. So we're very, very proud of that. I will tell you that the deer are plentiful, the turkeys are plentiful, the brook trout are plentiful, the wolves are plentiful, so forth. But also of interest, just yesterday I was at the Sheraton in the cities in Bloomington, and Camp Ripley won one of the Minnesota Great Awards for its work in recycling, and then a unit here out of the cities won another Minnesota Great Award for their innovation in battery recycling and so forth. So there were 10 Minnesota Great Awards, and the National Guard won 2 of them. So we figured we'd get 20% of the environmental awards that go with that. And it's also reached the national radar screen as a potential regional training center, which means economic development for the region and federal dollar input to Camp Ripley, which always should make all of us very happy. We have a Joint Forces Headquarters, which is an initiative at the national level. By joint, it's simply saying two or more branches working together. Well, we are Army and Air, and we are working together. The majority of our population is, of the roughly 12,900 troops that we do have, over 10,000 of them are Army, so you can see the ratio there. We have this organization, and this is the headquarters organization that also has multiple hats, i.e. should there be a homeland security situation, disaster, whatever, these would be the ones that were doing it. If you've not seen our Joint Operations Center at the Cedar Street Training Center, we will be more than happy to give you a personal tour to take a look at it. It's state-of-the-art technology. Its most significant thing about it is when we deal with the feds, we have to be in secure networks. And we have that capability complete. We've now got the governor's office, well, he was last year too, hooked up so he can talk on secure communications nationally. We can do it nationally, and we have been working with the counties, the sheriff's departments, the U.S. Marshal, so forth, and it's going very, very well for us. So this slide here shows you the roll-up, if you will, for Army and Air. And right now, the governor, as commander-in-chief, has control over 12,951 soldiers and airmen of a variety of skill sets to support our nation. Because our second mission, of our federal and state mission, the state mission is we are at the direction of the governor to assist the citizens of the state of Minnesota in emergencies. The thing that you need to know about this very simply is if the governor calls us out, the checkbook is also called out. That's probably the most significant difference. That's why the general rule of thumb is they work through the county sheriff in particular that will request the governor. And then the most common question that should be asked by anyone of a legislative level is, have you exercised or used all of the resources available to you, i.e. in your county? And also, you should have some agreements with adjacent counties. And the best example would be fire departments. Most fire departments have partnerships with other fire departments. So it's a two-engine, three-engine, five-engine type of thing. And then, so we're not a use for people to avoid expenses, per se. However, there are times and situations that require us to be. The most recent one, here's a series, I'll just give you examples, I won't go through in great detail, but in 2002, these are what we call man days. It's one person paid one day. So it could have been, well, it can't be one person 1,095 days, but it breaks out. And again, we try to get them in and get them out of there as quickly as possible. As you can see there, oh, by the way, when you pay your taxes this year, that is the most probable time there will be the guard called out for a type of wildfire. One year it was April 13th, another year it was April 14th, so we got that all calendared out. So anyway, and I'm a little worried this year with it. Hopefully the snow now will make that consistent. In 2004 and 2005, again, you can see the situations there. Our federal mission, I just want to point out, you would date yourself severely if you ever use the word weekend warrior again. In fact, if you monitor the national discussion going on about whether the guard is to be the cut or so forth, we were called the weekend warriors because we were a strategic force that was designed to say you will train one weekend a month and 2 weeks during each summer, if you are typical. However, with the downsizing in the 90s, the guard had to be relied upon as an operational force. So instead of strategic, we are operational. And by operational, that means you will be prepared to be deployed. And as we'll point out, that we have been deployed all over. We are an integral part of the active Army and Reserve. We have been consisting of approximately 40% of the ground forces in Iraq. We have taken over the Bosnian and Kosovo missions, and we are also taking over the training of the Afghan National Army in Afghanistan. So, and that's on the guard side. The interesting component to this is that we're cost effective with about a 12.5% to dollar ratio. What I'm saying is the National Guard is very cost effective. Once we're activated, we are paid the full weight, the same or wage, same as the active component. But otherwise, we're back to those one weekend a month and so forth. So there's a lot of discussion going on, especially as they're trying to balance the budget on the national level. I will tell you, you'll hear a lot of stuff in the national news about cutting the Guard and what impact. The most common question you'll have is what impact does that have on the National Guard in the state of Minnesota? And right now, having seen some of the preliminaries, it'll be minimal or none. In fact, the damage might be is they want to give us more force structure. Minnesota is the number one recruiting state in the nation. We are at 111% of required on the Army side, 103% on the Air Force side. We have just received the National Guard's ACOE Army Communities of Excellence Award. We then were put up into an all-Army competition and was one of the five. We were the winner for the National Guard period. And then was just out in D.C. and got the Bronze Award for the Army Performance Excellence Award, the national level. We're dealing with Army Research Centers, and the second place was Fort Stewart, Georgia, and then the Minnesota National Guard. And I want you to know I was very, very proud of the state of Minnesota, but it's sort of like breaking the glass barrier. To have a guard unit win it was, we just thought it would never happen, and we did it. So you can be very, very proud of the state. I will also tell you, in the state of Minnesota, right now the Red Bulls, the 1st Brigade Combat Team at Camp Shelby, is receiving national recognition and attention at the Pentagon. Right now, on all statistical objective performance criteria, are they trained, so forth, et cetera, equipped, the Minnesota National Guard, the 1st Brigade, 34th Brigade Combat Team, is number one in the country. I'm not talking guard, I'm not talking reserve, I'm not talking active, I'm talking everybody. So when you get the most common question asked, are they properly equipped, are they properly prepared, are we sending them off, totally no. They are, the evaluators are saying they're ready now, but we got to go through the exercise at Fort Polk because we've already hired the contractors to do it. But it's going to be a go out and do your stuff. They are, and again, when you walk the halls, all you have to do is say, we're from Minnesota. And actually, the most common comment we're getting is, we're so sick and tired of hearing about Minnesota. And that's good news. Next slide. Where have we been? We have been all over the world, and that is the price that we are paying for being an operational force. For some cases, like in the Air Force, they go on short tours, and that's kind of a nice deal. But we now have some of our troops, to include sons of members of this committee, who are on their second tour. I've had the honor of escorting Congressman Peterson, Gutnick, also Senators Dayton down there, and the amazing part about it is how positive they are. We have representatives from INSCU here as we get more and more in the partnerships in education, and a lot of the troops are saying, you know, we're just taking some time off. You know, and they knew what they were getting into, and they're doing it, so anyway, we're just extremely proud of these troops. So, the roll-up on this is since 9/11, we have had orders for deployments of 11,120 people. Now, that includes some that have gone twice, so there's a little double counting in this. But I have 12,900, and we've had 11,120 deployments. So you can see everyone's pretty well actively engaged. And we are continuing with our record enrollment and recruiting. The doors have not stopped. Okay. In the old days, pre-9/11, I would say the number one reason for joining the National Guard was education. I will tell you now, it's service above anything else. They know what they're getting into. Anyone who says someone didn't tell them that they might be deployed is brain dead. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So just be aware of that. Communities impacted by the 1st Brigade at Camp Shelby is 585 different communities. Now, don't take a star and say, well, does that my town? We just said we couldn't get 585 stars on that. But that is it. They are just... they're just doing magnificently. So if you don't think this is a state issue, you're wrong. And I have been visiting the communities all across. My goal initially was 22. I'm up to 16, and I think we're going to go beyond the 22. When I go to these communities, I visit with four centers of influence: the Ministerial Association, the School District Administration, law enforcement centers, and then a civic group. And then invariably I'll get a radio show or a TV interview in there too, depending on the community. And it's just to say, and here's the thing that every one of the representatives and any one of you that went down there would hear from the troops. What can I do for you is the question you would ask, and the answer is take care of my family. Take care of my family. Take care of my family. If there were five top questions, it would all be the same. So, with that in mind, here's what we're going to be asking you this year. Is we work with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and that is we believe that the state of Minnesota currently and some of the reintegration things that we've been doing has already received national attention. We have had CCOs done some things. If you've got access to Channel 5, KSTP, go to 5 on the Road of Jason Davis, and he's got a nice series on what he taped down there. Jack Rice has been down there. Jeanette Trumpeter is doing a series. They just did the first one on a reintegration, which I'll talk more about. But we've also gotten national inquiries from CBS and ABC. We're not sure where that will go. We've had inquiries from 12 different states already on what we've been doing. How can we emulate that? And then also our chaplain has been asked to be on a panel on a national conference. Actually, the second time he's been asked to be on a panel. One in March and one in May. The one in May will be for all Army, all Department of Defense, so with all the PhDs. So that's, we're quite proud of that. But our family programs has its mission, and that is to take care of our families prior to them being mobilized, while they're being mobilized, and then when they return home from active duty. In order to accomplish this, we have 11 centers all across the state of Minnesota. These are federally funded. It's just short of $1 million worth of funding that's come in for this. And their mission is to take care of the following. Before they get mobilized, they are eligible for TRICARE, the military's HMO, if you will, so they do get some medical support. We help them with pay issues, counseling, so forth. Then in mobilization, while they're gone, this is where the communities help in. I was just in Fergus Falls. The community raised $20,000 just to help the families do their routine things during the coming year. We've had other communities that have done nothing. Interestingly enough, the bigger the community, the less there seems to have been done. In turn, however, the great area here and some of benefactors. We do have the Minnesota Military Family Foundation, and there's also the Minnesota Military Appreciation Fund. Appreciation Fund is created to give people some money, but the Family Foundation, we have about a balance of about $500,000 right now. I have no control over it. I've been around the block long enough to know stay away. But they do ask me what my opinions are, and I'm willing to share them with them. But they are there as an emergency relief bill. We have bought tanks of propane and gas. We've bought airplane tickets for families to go see their son in Walter Reed. We've even paid money for families to go to their son's funeral. So the money is there. The community is there. So if you ask them, if someone says, you know, I want to send 30 boxes of used clothing, we don't need it. You know, but we need to take care of the families. Enough of that. The biggest issue that we are finding is in that third column, and that is the demobilization, getting them back and so forth. The troops, I will tell you, when they come back, they're fine. Hey, I haven't changed a bit. I'm cool. I'm macho duck. Okay, here we go. While the family, as the family's been working, we've handled over 30,000 calls and emails from family members. And it's variety. And we serve all branches. I think you can be especially proud of that. We do not discriminate. That includes the Family Military Foundation. So if you're Army, Navy, Air, Coast Guard, whatever, that's immaterial. The biggest problem we probably have with some of the other branches is communications. But we are working on that. And they're getting there. The most common questions of those 30,000 calls, first is medical, the TRICARE, if you will. How do we deal with that? Second is ID cards, because with their ID card, they get access to special privileges. We take care of that. And then the third one, I'm pleased to say, is communities calling in and saying, how can we help? So those are good. And there's a variety of other things. Some want counseling, powers of attorney, pay problems always present. So here's the new flagship. This is where we need your help. And that's on the reintegration program. The reintegration program is designed to train and resource every soldier and their family for a safe, healthy, and secure reintegration to the family, the community, the schools, and the jobs as they return from active duty. Now, it sounds pretty simple to say, hey, you're off active duty, you want to go back, everyone's thinking about it for a year, it should be a no-brainer, right? Well, it's not a no-brainer. It's not. It's the most common thing you're hearing in the media is, again, we need to support them, educate them, and assist them. We need to get them back as quickly as possible. For a lot of the ones that aren't married, the younger ones that are currently pulled out of school, that's why Minsky and University are here. How do we get them back in as quickly as possible? And then how do we prevent them from spiraling into post-traumatic stress disorder? I hate that word. It's probably the most benign. I will tell you, it is not a military phenomenon. There's two, combat stress. Every one of them will have experienced combat stress. If you ignore that stress and don't know how to deal with that stress and force them to push it and suppress it like they did with the Vietnam era, you will get post-traumatic stress disorder. So we have a moral and ethical responsibility to these troops to take care of that. A lot of them, and again, it's flippantly used. I will tell you, there isn't a young person who's driven a car that's been in an accident, that one of the passengers has been killed, that doesn't have post-traumatic stress. There's a lot of emergency medical technicians who drive the streets in Minnesota and come upon an accident that don't have post-traumatic stress, or at least occupational stress. So please don't just allow your constituents to label it as a military problem. It is not a military problem. It's a social problem. That's my editorial for today. I apologize. Now, since 2005... we have returned, and like I say, since December, 1,075 soldiers coming from combat zones, to include the unit that lost three of its own. Okay, the five phases, we talked about getting them ready with the pre-mob. As we do that, in the pre-mobilization, we work with the families and train them before the troops actually come back home. We also go out, and through the partnership with the Veterans Affairs, we fly staff members out there and set them down and start going through some of the paperwork. Okay? And we try to do as much as we can up front, because the competition we have are the hugs and kisses. They want the hugs and kisses. Okay? We bring them back, and sure enough, they get the hugs and kisses, and then we force them to stay there for 2 extra days, and they think we are the meanest, cruelest persons in the world. But we talk about what they will experience. And if I should have saved all my Christmas cards, but they were personal, and I didn't. From spouses and from parents who said thank you. And I'm going to read a letter here shortly just to emphasize, but it is indicative. We go through this and saying, here's what's happening. And then we bring them back every 30 days. Now, the Department of Defense official policy is, you got 90 days off. Go forth and do great things. Well, these young people, after the hugs and kisses last maybe 5 days. One day they will wake up. Normally, the experts say in 2 weeks they'll wake up one day and they'll say, is that all there is? This does not meet the expectations I dreamt about for the last year. This is boring. As one parent said, my son got on the phone, called his 5 buddies, and he took off, and there's someplace on a beach in Florida. Because he has a new family. Yeah. And that's the buddies that are with him over that year. So those are the things that we need to take a look at. And you try to explain that to a spouse and so forth, and all of a sudden if you say, here's what's going to happen, and oh my God, and this would happen to a parent, it is happening. The parent says, my son's normal. That's a lot better than my son's sick. Mm-hmm. He's normal, we know it, and we deal with it. So we bring him back at the 30, 90, 60, and 90 days. And again, like I say, we actually are violating official Defense Department policy. Official policy says you will not bother them for 90 days. And that, we just totally believe on that. So, and then finally, I want to talk about the bottom line there and the fifth dimension. This is what the governor is leading into and so forth. We've been asked to provide input to the governor's office, to the Veterans Affairs, and herself. And like I say, I am a provider. I don't have a lot into this other than saying I want to make sure Veterans Affairs takes care of my troops when they come home. Okay, so when we look at this, we're trying to get that the fifth dimension is getting all of the, what I've been amazed with, a lot of the agencies exist. They just don't crosstalk. And so one of the things is, how do we get all these things together? Well, we have the state agencies, our health department, MNSCU, university, or chambers and so forth. Something as simple as job fairs would be wonderful. Indeed, we could be involved with that. Our faith base, I'm visiting with the ministerial associations. And by the way, that's one of the key triads. Families will hug and kiss them. Employers will be glad they're back. But ask this question. Will the pastor give them a hug? Think about that. You know, we all grew up, we're a faith-based state. So that's what I tell the chaplain or the ministers in the face of it. They're going to come back and they're going to ask permission, because they may have shot someone or shot at someone or are going through some things that are just bothering them. And that's not the time to get rejection from something you were told and confirmed in, etc. So I wasn't going to do that. But veterans organizations have been absolutely wonderful. The county veterans organizations we're working with, and then the feds, of course. Let me read this letter. Jeanette Crumpeter did a series up in Duluth as part of the reintegration, and they did a series, the first one, of, I think one of three. February is sweeps week, and right now we're hot. So, well, since April of 2005, we've had 1,700 soldiers go through our family reintegration. We've trained 800 of our FRGs, volunteers, if you will, on this reintegration, and we've trained over 350 community members. But here's the message. Dear WCCO team, my son was on active duty with the 151 and just returned home from Iraq the first part of December. We had the opportunity to listen to Sergeant Huff during our reintegration program. He had told us exactly what was in your article and so much more. Because our soldier had just returned the day before he spoke to us, we had no idea as to what we would expect from a returning soldier. What is normal? What is not normal? They, the soldiers, all seemed normal when they first came back. But as time goes by, it's been about 2 months now, we're finding out that some of our soldiers are having problems. Sergeant Huff and the rest of the reintegration team helped us as parents and spouses recognize some of those problems. Yes, some of the parents, spouses, and soldiers thought this program was a waste of time. But it is not a waste of time, anyone's time. Really, we really need to be alert as to any returning soldiers' action and get the word out there as quickly as possible. So that's kind of what's happening on that. So as you see with this in these dimensions, so we bring all of these organizations together. That's what we're asking. This is really a low-cost, no-cost type of opportunity. Okay, I get one here, but that's all right. This slide here is just kind of a summary slide of what we're trying to do. During this legislative session, we want to talk to you as much as possible how we can take care of those troops, those soldiers. You know, their families, they're involved, they're committed, they're not complaining. I'm just amazed at it. And as you know, this is no kidding stuff. It's we lost three of our own. We have about 30 Purple Hearts, the medal no one should strive to earn. They've been there, they've done that. I have seen combat action badges on young females. I have there's a young gal that's driven over 10,000 miles. She's 5'4" from Appleton, Minnesota. She holds the record in theater. You know, and these are what we're asking for our young people, and they're doing well. I will tell you, having been in Afghanistan and in Iraq in particular, commanders have gone out of the way and said, we need to talk to you. I said, I'm not here to visit them. These are active duty commanders. I'm not here to visit you. I'm here to visit the troops. They said, well, please get me out of trouble if you go see them. I go see them. Yes, what do you need? I just want you to know how proud and fortunate we are. The young gal in the group that she was with, the first cab was leaving country. They asked for them by name. And they had closer units. And the reason they asked for them, because we knew you'd get it done right and on time. And so Minnesota's doing very well. I'd like to leave with this last quote. Lieutenant Jason Timmerman was one of our three casualties, but before he left, he had the opportunity to speak at Lake Benton High School. And I'd just like to take a moment. If you just read that, I'd read it, but it chokes me up every time I do. So, that's what we're asking for your support for. Subject to your questions.
Thank you, Adjutant General. We do have several questions. First up, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would be, before I ask the question, I attended one of those reentry in Red Wing.
Okay.
And maybe you're aware of that.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I was impressed. And they also had a chaplain who is in the National Guard.
Chaplain Morris, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. And I tell you, when he spoke and what he said, even with that group of troopers, it got very quiet. It has an effect on the goodness of those people because they internalize what he said about them and that kind of thing. And I guess my question is, I was impressed with the situation and the presentation that was made is just outstanding. And I want to commend you in regard to that. And I guess the question that I would have is this system working as well as you had anticipated, or is it better?
Yeah, there's a whole series of emotions. It's working better. It started out with, I didn't realize we'd have to fight as hard, I remember getting up at a meeting and saying to the commanders, yeah, you don't have to do this, but you won't work for me if you don't. Well, okay, no one put it to me that way before. But, you know, that was, and after they went through it once, I have more disciples than you could imagine from that viewpoint. Chaplain Morris is our chaplain. We hired him. He was in Fallujah with the special ops, the special operations people. He literally, a chaplain who literally walked in the valley, if you will, using some religious terms. And he's totally committed. His passion is, you know, unquestionable. And he believes what he's doing and so forth. So I've been blessed by saying, you know what direction we want to go? And he says, yes. And I, it's like riding a horse and all you're doing is hanging on. He's that good. That, you know, my biggest fear now is he is so good that he is being used not only all across the state, but nationally also. And I'm trying to, as best I can, replicate as many of them. But as you know, his energy, he's synergized it, and our chaplain corps has grown exponentially. We're one of the few states that has a complete chaplain's corps. But they've got a mission, and they've got a sense of purpose. And all of a sudden, to have them do a little session, and then a day later, someone walks in and says, I heard you the other day, and I need to talk. Now, that's good stuff. So it's a national model. It exceeded my expectations. And you know what? Someone could easily say on the blog, well, God, they just thought of this. This is a no-brainer, which one person did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some from the outside looking in. But it's not a no-brainer. It's getting off the butt, if you will, and going doing it. And he's doing it. So he burns the candle at both ends. But thank you for those comments.
Paula for Plenty.
Yeah, yes, thanks. And the other thing that I would just ask, and that is has our National Guard been in any other division other than infantry? I mean, let's say, for example, could you transfer from that, let's say, to engineering?
Oh, okay.
Senator Schultz?
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, the 34th Infantry Division is made up of all these branches. Within the division, you got the infantry, but you also have artillery, engineers, air defense, you know, infantry and armor, and so forth. What's been unique about this war on terror is we took our artillery units out of southwest Minnesota, and we really made them all infantry / military police. They were driving the streets of Baghdad just like you would see a patrol car driving the streets of Minneapolis-St. Paul. You know, the Humvee is their patrol car, and they were doing a presence patrol, hopefully to keep problems down. We took our air defense artillery and made them military infantry MPs, so forth. So, yes, we have all these branches, but right now the coin of the realm is carrying a gun and walking the streets. And so we train every one of them. Now, the unit that's in Mississippi is our armor and our Bradley's personnel carriers, the big heavy stuff. But they'll be driving, theoretically, anything that comes in from Kuwait, Turkey, or Jordan will be guarded by our Minnesota troops. So they have to be on the road, and they have to be moving fast, and they got the big guns. And they don't. One of the safest things we learn about that over there is if you got a big gun, normally the insurgents let you pass. They want something more smaller and less re-engaging.
Okay, next up, Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General Shelto, I'm very interested in your integration program. It sounds like a good deal. One of the things that I came across, some of the Guard members that are being deployed are actually business owners. We talk a lot about training people when they come back to go into the workforce and that sort of thing. I'm aware of some situations, one particular, a business owner, when you leave your business for a year, year and a half, and you're the owner of a small business, you are the heart and soul of that business. In this particular case, he's having some difficulties with his business. Are there any programs at all that you're aware of that help someone coming back or planning to leave to help with transitioning or maintaining a business during their time of absence, or just help them financially when they get back, some sort of programs, whatever. Anything you're aware of for a business owner who is trying to maintain what he had before he left?
Madam Chair, Representative, I know the small, well, no. That's something maybe Clark can help me with a little bit here. We do have small business owners who have deployed. In fact, some of them, we have one that had a small trucking company that sold all his trucks before he left. He just bit the bullet, and that was tough. We've had others who were small contractors that lost their client base, mm-hmm. and they came back and had to reestablish because everything is contacts. I read about in the literature. Oh, then there's the Small Business Administration's got sites. You got a website here, a website there, mm-hmm. and so forth. And but if you want something around the corner, I'm not totally aware of it. I think the Veterans Administration. And these are part of the initiatives that we want to take a look at. And as we get into this partnership, we want to look at, like, say, the Department of Economic Development, and what role could they play? You know, they're existing, they're staffed, and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, from the troop side, I like to see job fairs, but you just added another dimension. What are we doing to help with the small business person in that way? So I don't have a clean answer to that, but maybe someone else does.
And to this point, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and General Shelton, and Representative Demmer. We have a group that's been meeting, and actually we talked about this yesterday, and I think the Veterans Department will address the very question that you're talking about, but there are a lot of areas out there. There's a need for networking, as the General had spoke to, and so we did take it on to call those people directly and make sure that they understand what those benefits are. There is an SBA program that deals specifically with that, so... I'll leave that to the veterans' presentation as well.
Next up, Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General, I was talking to a friend of mine the other night. He works senior staff, Air Education and Training Command for Active Duty Air Force. Don't be too impressed. I've seen him with a lit cigarette stuck up his nose when he passed out. I'm not going to say who stuck that cigarette up his nose either, but he told me that the Air Force Active Duty is drawing down by 30,000 troops. Kind of concerned me. Do you know anything about this, and is that going to affect our operations tempo?
Madam Chair, Representative Seibert, yes, it's in all the national. I've heard figures as high as 57,000 out of the Air Force cutting. And again, have you ever heard the phrase, don't worry about it, it's just politics? It's what I'm getting at is right now both Army and Air are going through a cultural fight. This is my personal opinion now. A cultural fight is they want all the latest and greatest technology. They want the F-22 fighters. They want the Joint Strike Fighters and so forth, which are big ticket items. And if you were to take a look at the Air Force Times and so forth, they'd have a big article saying, well, the one interesting one is the cost difference between an active Air Force person and a guard or reserve person, and they're looking at their cost savings. So one of the arguments would be is they're going to beef up the guard and reserve, and then the personnel cost savings they will save with new aircraft, new airframes. So for some reason the Department of Defense is enamored with new technology. Now you take that same argument, for example, 2-3 weeks ago, they were talking about the National Guard being cut 17,000, of which and I've seen a roster of what the NGB proposal would be. The state of Minnesota, because of our strength format, would grow 1,000, which we don't want. I say very cautiously, because right now we're at a peak. Once you accept that 1,000, you got to maintain that 1,000. So, but there's other states that would lose 1,000. And so forth and more. So this is going back and forth. Colonel Shields was just out there. He sat with in the back of the room as Senator Dayton was on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and we visited with Representative Klein and the House Armed Services Committee talking about these things, and the money's going to start showing up. There is a lot of restructuring going on. And it's got to be shaken out. And a lot of the political people are saying, you know, what's going on? In the greatest time of need or use, I mean, you read in the paper all the time that we're abused and overused, that the Department of Defense would think that we need to cut back. But they just finished what is called a quadrennial defense review, and the vision of the future is that we won't need that large force much anymore. Army's looking more for special operations, and the Air Force is looking for over-the-horizon type of aircraft, it seems like, that can destroy things so far away that it will be totally superior. And that's got a lot of people nervous and scared. But they're also designing, they did a pitch and did some buyout packages also, so people that were asked to leave early would get a golden parachute. So we don't know. It's going back and forth, and it's in the halls of the Congress right now. It's a poor answer to a really complex question, but it changes every day. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you.
Any further questions for General Shillitoe? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General, I know you don't make policy. You just execute orders. Andy, lean forward or back so I can say thanks, buddy. Concerning these temporary flight restrictions that the FAA imposes on us from time to time, where do your orders come from to put F-16s on station on some of those?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I'd even like to know that. No, seriously, the air wings have direct communication with the national level. I only heard about those capping missions literally after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the Air Force operates. So whether you're out west, well, you got the big First Air Force, and they got both the East Coast and the West Coast discovered and so forth. But there's, I was out at Scott Air Force Base, and you looked at a wraparound room. That's the for all the transport planes, not the fighters. But they just got wall-to-wall screens and so forth, and they got a number for every plane and where it's at and so forth, and they say, I need planes to cap Minneapolis, St. Paul. Who's the closest? It's Duluth. They shoot a direct mission order to them. They say, we're paying for it. Do it. Mm-hmm. We have people up there that are sitting on alert. They have to be in the air within 10 minutes at all time. We're even building a little nice house for them so they can be right next to the hangar. And they do dry runs and real runs, and the Air Force, unfortunately, has been trained to be very secretive. So
we've noticed,
you know. But again, that's their mission. But yeah, they it's from the national level, and they're the bill payers too. I mean, we've just agreed to allow them to have the air base there.
Follow up, Representative Beard.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Whenever they put Blackhawks or Cobras on station, does that come from the Air Force too? I noticed some of the TFRs, they've actually been using helicopters to chase down the slower planes because it's difficult to get an F-16 slowed down to catch a 150 or something.
Madam Chair, Senator Beard, we have never used a Blackhawk
here,
to my knowledge, in one of those capping type missions.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always been the F-16s. And you're right. I mean, they're
right now.
They're flying at minimized 400 or 500 miles an hour, you know, it's like I say, we have not used the helicopters.
Thanks.
Any further questions for Agent General Shillitoe? Thank you for your presentation, and we will watch with interest during the mid-March deployment and hope that all of our troops come home safe. Thank you for your hard work.
Right. And on behalf of all the troops of the Minnesota National Guard, thank you for your past support. That support is paying off, I think, big dividends nationally. Remember, 95.5% of my budget comes from federal dollars. We are a net taxpayer rather than consumer.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Members, we're going to have just a little quick transition here. In your packet is military and veterans enactments, House research information briefs. I'd like Mr. Cleary to just give us a brief overview of that before we move on to the next item. Mr. Cleary.
Members and staff and
attendance. I just wanted to say you've all seen this before. This is a summary of what you've done last year in terms of military enactments. Just to remind you, put it in context, last year was the biggest year I've seen here in 30 years for military and veterans legislation. Many of the things you did last year were fixes to laws, as you know. Some were some, of course, were policy sorts of things, tax benefits, and education, tuition reimbursement increases, and so on. But most were fixes, and so that's all captured in this document. I'm sure you've seen it. Let me refer you to a single page that we just handed out that speaks to proposals that are in the works for the coming year. Many of these proposals, those grouped on the first page, have already been adopted by the governor in the governor's bill, and they have a lot of momentum. I would expect many of them would pass, perhaps all of them. And there are others that are under consideration, too. Representative Severson, with Representative Seibert and Representative Wardlow and others have put together a group of a veterans advisory group, and I think Representative Severson could say a little more about that. But that advisory group speaks pretty broadly for soldiers throughout the state, soldiers and veterans, young and old, and including those just returning. And they brought together, it's just a wonderful forum for brainstorming and shaking out various alternatives for the legislature. They've brought forward a great many proposals. Those have been fed to the governor. They've been fed to others. They've made their way around. And many of them have already been adopted. Others might be. There are probably other ideas still coming forward. And those are captured to some extent on this single page here. And so, Madam Chair, that's all I really have to say unless there are questions.
Thank you. And I think we'll be hearing more about this during Representative Severson's presentation here, agenda item number 5. But before we get there, I'd like to turn the gavel over to one of the veterans on our committee, Representative Seibert, and we'll do the Department of Veterans Affairs update with Commissioner Dyrud.
Afternoon, Commissioners. If you state your name for the record, please.
Commissioner Clark Dyrud, Commissioner of Veterans Affairs.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Michael Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Veterans Affairs. Thanks for having us here this morning.
Thanks for joining us. Go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you. What I'd like to do this morning is give some introductory remarks and then have Deputy Commissioner Pugliese bring you up to date on the legislative issues from last session, and then I'll end with talking a little bit about the upcoming initiatives. The Department of Veterans Affairs is truly one of the smallest organizations in the state. We've been very low-key, and I think General Shalitoe has set the stage very well for some of the issues that we have been dealing with. Personally, I'd just like to mention I was a walking poster child of what he talked about. I left Vietnam in a combat unit in January of 1968, and 48 hours later, I was a civilian back in Minnesota and wondering what was going on. And over the next 3.5 years or so, I literally wandered around the world. I had probably 25 jobs, you know, worked long enough to get some money to keep going. And my life seemed perfectly normal to me. So, I mean, it just, you know, that was just the way it was. Finally, in 1973, back in my hometown of Thief River Falls, I answered an ad and became the County Veteran Service Officer. And that began a career that has brought me to the chair. I was service officer there for a few years, and I started working with the state in 1980. And most of the years that I worked with the state, I was with the Claims Division. Now I'd like to just leave that for a minute and talk about our department. Our department, as I said, is very small. We have two major areas, a claims division and a benefits division. And the claims division exists because of a law passed in 1870 that said attorneys can only be paid $10 for helping veterans get any benefits from the federal government. That law is still in effect to this day, and therefore the various state agencies and private service organizations can provide advocacy service at no charge to the veteran. In exchange, the VA will give free office space and telephone lines. So our claims division, I'm very proud of it, of course, having been part of it for many years, but our claims division represents 50% of the veterans who have representation and are drawing dollars from the federal government. 50% of them are represented by our claims division. So we're very proud of that. Veterans Administration benefits brought into the state are over $600 million annually, and the VA hospital side brings in over $400 million annually. So we're talking about over $1 billion of benefits coming into the state every year through the VA. Our other division is called the Benefits Division, and we have a pool of money called the State Soldiers Assistance Program, SSAP, which we'll be referring to later. The SSAP is a pool of money that we are to use for the legislation from the 40s, talks about serving veterans and their families. It is a fairly unique program in that it can help the family members as well as the veterans. There's only one problem. We have not been given many funds in that program. We have not been getting any increases since 1973, when I first started using the program as a county service officer. There really haven't been increases to speak of, and there have been whittling away of it over the years. So our program has very low guidelines in how we can help the veterans. It also has caused us to cut a couple of the areas that we used to help. But I will be talking more about that when we talk about the initiatives. The one thing to remember about that program is there are very few restrictions as to how that can be used, as long as it is to be helping veterans and their families. So that I will be getting back to that. Last session was absolutely amazing for us in the Veterans Affairs community. There is, as has already been alluded to, there are many veterans-related issues that were passed. And the one I wanted to just talk about, and then Deputy Commissioner Pugliese will give more specific information, and that, of course, was the Support Our Troops license plate. And we have a copy of it, and you start seeing them out in the community. This is very important both to military affairs and to veterans affairs. As you remember, 50% of the proceeds of this plate, which is $30 extra, goes to the military affairs. And part of the slides from General Charito is talking about what's available for the families. You know, the troops that take care of the families. There is the family assistance program that 50% of this money will be going to. The 50% that we will be getting deal with an outreach program and MACV, things that Michael will be bringing up to speed on that. The plate itself, but parenthetically, the eagle up there is a real eagle, a real fashion model, Harriet from the Wabasha Eagle Center. And she was actually airbrushed out to get rid of the feathers that were sticking up in the top of her head. But we plan on having Harriet at some of the veterans organization meetings this summer. So anyway, this has been just a boon to us. And there are also some other issues that you need to be brought up to speed on. And I'll now turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Mike Pugliese for some of those issues.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Mike Pugliese, Deputy Department of Veterans Affairs. Since we were just talking about the license plate, I'll just bring you up to speed on some of the current numbers that we've had. It was made available, I believe, on the 19th of December. So from the 19th of December through January, we have sold 3,673 plates, which has generated $116,615. So we are a little bit ahead of schedule of what we predicted we would be able to raise with the license plate, so that's really good news. As Commissioner mentioned, we get 50% of the proceeds from the sale of the plate. We're using that to fund our outreach program. We're also using that for a homeless initiative through the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. We're also using some of that to fund some of the service organizations and with help of their programs in the community, especially the ones that have claims offices that represent veterans before the federal government. So it's really going to be a big help, and so far it's been going really well. So we're very excited about that. A few other things I want to bring up to speed on. World War II Veterans Memorial. It's been floating around for several years. We finally have raised all the money, and I'm excited to say that on March 1st, we will be advertising for bids, and we will be closing those bids on March 22nd. And we're very hopeful that there will be a construction date of mid-April. So hopefully late summer it will be completed. We can have a nice dedication ceremony sometime around that point. For those of you that aren't aware of it, it's going to be right out on the Capitol Mall between the current Korean Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial. Beautiful location. There's a little poster that's out there which shows the design, so feel free to go out there and check it out. Maybe not today or tomorrow, but when the weather permits. So we're very excited. I'm actually meeting with some people this afternoon regarding it. I have to go over some of the final details. Some of you might be aware, we did go out for bid several months ago, and the bids came in extremely high. Concrete and steel, the prices were going up, so the bids came in extremely high. So we raised some more money. We reduced the scope and scale of the memorial a little bit, took away some of the more expensive materials, such as the granite. Not too much of it, though. We really kept the overall appearance of it intact, so it's still going to be a beautiful memorial worthy of honoring our World War II veterans and the sacrifices they made. The last thing I want to bring up to speed on is our outreach initiative. And as I mentioned, the license plate does help fund our outreach initiative. And our outreach program is mainly focused at serving minority veterans, female veterans, and homeless veterans, although they will serve any veteran that they come in contact with out in the community. And in a little over a year, and we just started with one person, and it was really just intended to be a pilot project and see how it went, and it's really taken off. So we're using the funds from the plate to fund the rest of it. But with just about one person, a little over a year, we have he's contacted and helped over 140 veterans. To date, he has brought in $1.634 million in benefits to those 140 veterans that he's come in contact with. The monthly amount that's coming in is over $136,000. So it certainly has proven to be a very cost-effective program and certainly a worthwhile investment. As a result of it, with the funding from the license plate, we've brought on two additional outreach workers. They're currently being trained through our office in conjunction with the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. One of them is going to be working very closely with the Native American and the reservations. There's a strong need out there, and we've been trying to serve them for a while, but it's very difficult to get out there and help them and work with them. So this is really going to be a vital part of continuing to work with them, and they've welcomed this project with open arms. So we're very excited about continuing to work with them. The other gentleman that was hired is going to be working currently in the metro area. That's where the most significant need is. So we're very excited about it. The program is certainly proven itself, is helping many, many individuals. And part of the outreach is doing a lot of different types of seminars, benefit seminars, outreach, some of the town halls. And I know there are several members on this committee that have had some town halls in their hometowns and their districts. That's part of it. We want to get out there, and using this program, we can get out in the communities to help educate the veterans, the families, the County Veteran Service officers, as well as yourselves, so that you know what's available out there. And for those of you who have participated in the town halls, you can see by all the players that are out there, there are many, many services available. One of the problems is trying to coordinate all those services. And I think that's a little bit about what the commissioner will be talking about. But at this point, I'd open up for questions on any of the three initiatives or projects I just shared with you. If you'd like more information, please ask.
Thank you. Are there any questions from any members? Anyone?
I just wanted to congratulate you and your staff for the town hall meetings that you did. I know I had one in my district, and it was phenomenal. I've gotten such positive feedback, and it was done very, very well, so I thank you and your staff for doing that.
Thank you.
And I understand one of your outreach guys, he was ex-military, very well-trained guy.
Someone near and dear to your heart, I believe. That would be Gerald.
Gerald Wells. I used to be his first sergeant, so it was great to see him working out there. So thank you, Commissioner, and Deputy Commissioner. I appreciate your time.
Ben, I want to talk about the initiatives. So I would like to continue, if I may.
Yes, you may.
All right, thank you. And again, I'd like to refer back to General Shorto's testimony. He talked about coming back. Okay, so now you heard what is going on while they are on active duty. But where there is really a problem is once they are back and in their communities, and that's where our department comes in. As General Shelito has said in the past, they will be in the military for 1 to 6 more years. They will be veterans forever. And what has happened with our various programs, we've been very small, we've been flying below the radar, but we have been meeting with several groups, and the governor came through with a very historic set of initiatives. Since 1973, again, I'm not aware of a governor coming forward with hardly any initiatives relating to veterans. And back on December 19th, the governor came forward with a whole set of initiatives. So we are very excited about that. I'd like to talk just about some of these and kind of tie them together, how they fit into the big picture. First of all, there is we want to increase the money to the SSAP program. That has been whittled away to almost nothing. We would like to be able to reinstate the programs that have been ended. We would like to be able to increase, for example, the housing allowance for a, we have a, one part of it would be a temporary financial assistance for a veteran that is disabled temporarily. Right now, the housing allowance maximum that we can allow for a veteran and spouse is $425. That's not very realistic anymore, you know, things of that nature. But more importantly, this is a program that can be very nimble. Once they have left the military and are back in the communities and are having all sorts of problems, we are able to respond very quickly through this program. And so what we are looking for is a series of, is an increase in funding to the SSAP. The other area that is very important is a system of campus reps for colleges, universities, both techs around the state. This could be anything from a work-study situation in a smaller college or VOTEC, all the way up to someone full time. When the people get back from a combat zone, it is very hard to get back into a school system. They run into all sorts of problems, and generally speaking, will just leave rather than stick around. And I've experienced that myself. And it's been very important to military affairs that there be a system in place to help people coming back from the military wanting to go to school. This would be mostly this would be peer related. There would be veterans that have from that era themselves, and so that is a very important part of this. Obviously, to get someone, what good is having the quote GI Bill for education if you don't use it? And that really is a problem. And one of the major problems can be taken care of so simply by just having a peer there, someone to talk to, someone to work through red tape, things of that nature. So that is a very important part. Then the other area is something that you've heard alluded to, and that's the County Veteran Service Officer System. Minnesota is very fortunate. They were created in about 1945. They have a very excellent County Veteran Service Officer System. They are funded by each individual county. So there is a great variety in the funds available in a given county. It is very, you saw the map with all the stars all around the state. The new veterans coming back are going to be spread out around the state. They should be able to have full access to the full range of benefits no matter where they are. And so one of the proposals is a Veteran Service Officer Enhancement Grant. And this would be most likely divided up based on population. That would be a factor, of course. But then there would also be benchmarks that would be set for the service officers to meet in order to qualify for the grant. This grant would have very few restrictions as to how it could be used because each county knows the needs for their counties. It's some of the rural counties, it might be transportation to get veterans in. In some of the very small counties where it's part-time, it might be some additional money for additional staff. I mean, so the idea is not to create roadblocks as to how this can be used. So this would be such an important part to increase the awareness. Oh, by the way, the most important part of the benchmarks would be they would have to be doing outreach within their communities. Anything like town halls, and like I said, we've been to several town halls. We really enjoy doing those, and we really appreciate the support we've gotten from you folks about that. But they would be expected to do something like that in their communities. They would be expected to get out to all the service organizations. They would be expected to get things in newspapers, in radio, TV if possible. But they would have to document that they are actually, because they're in some of the smaller communities, they just don't do that. And so this would be, they would have funds, they would have to show that they are, making an effort to get the word out. I think the bottom line, I've said this before, and I've said it again, and probably will say it several more times, there are benefits for veterans, but once they're out, veterans just do not know about them. And it's a bewildering array of benefits. It really is. And so it's an ongoing problem is how to get the word out to the veterans, and that's where the county veteran service officers come in, and that's where outreach comes in, and so that this is a very important piece of this. Another area is something that is long overdue in the state of Minnesota, and that is the Minnesota is one of nine states that continues to tax the military retiree pay, and that is we think that's being penny-wise but pound-foolish. There is revenue that is generated from that, of course. But what happens, military retirees leave the service around the age of 40. And they invariably start, they're highly trained. They start second careers. They have spouses who work. We are losing the new military retirees, they are going to other states. And military retirees are very used to traveling. They're very used to moving. And they have a very excellent network. And believe me, they do look at where to settle when they're getting out of the military. And they are very much aware of which states tax and which don't. And this is, we are losing an incredible resource. Not only the finance, I've talked about the financial part, because in addition to the taxes from their earnings, there would be, of course, the goods and services bought, et cetera, et cetera. And then there is the quality of people that we would be bringing into the state, retaining and keeping. I mean, these are first-class individuals with marvelous skills, marvelous training. So this, to ease the pain, this proposal would phase this process over a four-year period. It's roughly, I think, $19 million is the amount of revenue generated. But this, would be phased in over four years. So I think that this is something that's long overdue, and I think it's real. We have a very low percentage of military retirees in our state. Only 3% of only 3% of veterans in this state are military retirees. And it should be up. It should be 9%, 10%, something on that order. Some of the states that have a lot of bases will have up to 20% of the veterans being military retirees. But what happens, we end up losing them when they first are out. We have a much higher percentage of military retirees over the normal retirement age. In other words, beyond 65, something in that order. They will then come back. But meanwhile, we are losing them from that period when they are first getting out. So this is something that I think is long overdue and would be of great value to the state. Those are just some of the, let's see, the, absolutely. The one thing that I wanted to talk about is probably a very important part at this time, and that is to create, it's a, we're asking for a couple of staff members. We want to create a one-stop shopping website for all veterans-related matters, and also a coordinator position. General Shelton alluded to the fact that there will be a sub-cabinet that will be starting here very soon, where the state agencies are going to get together. We'll be talking about what we have relating to veterans in our own agencies. But there's a much broader problem out there, and that is there's all sorts of federal, private sector agencies, people that have things dealing with veterans. And one of the hardest things to do is to coordinate this, pull this together. What we want to do is to have a, first of all, a website that would be, as I said, one stop. You would be able to, if you're interested in small business administration things, or small business matters, like you referred to, you could go tracking down there. For example, we found out there are loans for small business owners and things of this nature. They could be tracked down that. If they're interested in school, if they're interested in hospital care, if they're interested in, whatever, you'd be able to go down that path. However, at least initially, it is important to get a person out visibly, literally throughout the state, who pulls agencies and individuals together, but also can provide information, marketing information, if you will, about what is going on. Because, of course, not everyone uses the web. So you also need to pull the information together, pull the services together. So this would be a very important part right now is to get something that can pool all those resources. So those are I think I will stop there. Again, I can't thank you enough for what you did last session, and really look forward to support in the coming session, because it is really time. Our little agency, there's a lot of work that we have to do, and we need your help to do it effectively. Are there any questions?
Acting Chair Cyrus. Like that?
I do. Vice Chair Better.
I just made that up.
Could you hang on for just a second?
Excuse me, sir.
Dempsey was in front of you. Representative Dempsey.
I guess my suggestion might be is that I know that you present information to the veterans and that kind of thing. But one of the problems that sometimes veterans have, and that is that they are not aware as to what is there to their advantage or that will be of help to them. And you say, for example, some of the veterans are to have maybe they don't have a computer. They don't have a television system, or they don't. And I think it would be wisdom in action on your part is to you take the initiative to contact the veteran and say, here are some of the things that we can do to help you, whether it be to increase your income or to reduce your taxes or whatever else the case may be. I think is a position that would be exceedingly appreciated, number one, and I think it's something that should be done. Because what you're doing, you're putting, again, the responsibility on somebody else. The responsibility to help the veteran is your responsibility. And the more you can do that, and I'm not telling you how to run, I'm not saying that, but that's with anything, just like being in a school. It's the administration that's responsible to see that the kids get the education. And that is true in this kind of a situation. So I would just make as a suggestion, and I hope we don't have to pass legislation to tell you what to do. I don't like that. But my point is that those kind of creative things come from your department that you're accountable for, and you go out and be the leader in informing, rather than having those people have to come to you. You go to them. Just a suggestion.
Commissioner Harvin?
Chair Seibert, or Acting Chair Seibert, or whatever.
First Sergeant's fine, too.
Representative Dempsey, that's exactly the intent of two of these. The website one, that's only one part of it, is the website. The other would be, and the title, we're not quite sure, coordinator, something like that. But that person is a real live person that goes out to, it would start going out to other agencies, finding all the benefits, but work on getting the word out, pulling resources together, and getting the word out in real life, as opposed to the cyberspace, which the other part would be doing. The other part of that is the service officer enhancement. In order to get the grant, they have to reach certain benchmarks, and one of those benchmarks will be outreach in their own community. I've seen you out in Goodhue County, and you have a very excellent county service officer there who does those information meetings. This would help other counties do something similar, work on getting the word out through radio, TV, newspapers, informational meetings, things of that nature. So that is you've hit the nail on the head. In our line of work dealing with the veterans, that is the biggest problem we have, is getting the word out to the veterans. And that's what we really want to work on. And we take that charge very seriously, and that's why we are asking for your help. But thank you for those comments. That's exactly it.
Along those lines, Commissioner, I have understanding that your outreach program is one of the few in the nation. Is that true?
We think so. We take an individual, and who actually goes out into communities and physically tracks down people. And word of mouth is important in that, especially because we're dealing there with minority veterans, homeless veterans. And it's something that seems to be growing, and word of mouth, we're getting more and more referrals. But that program, someone from who's trained to our claims division actually goes out. I think some of you, I like this, equate it to that old Paladin show, have gun, will travel. I mean, in this case, they have a briefcase and will travel, and they'll go right out into the community and track a person down and physically take the form, complete the paperwork, and keep that following up, working with it up to and including if there has to be an appeal, things of that nature. So that is one area, where we are tracking down, getting them their veterans' benefits. But there's a much wider range of veterans' issues out of there. As Representative Demmer referred to, small business, there's school, there's hospital care, there's all this wide range. And so that is our charge, is to find a way to get that information out. Because, as General Shelton referred to, once they come back into the communities, it's very easy for their lives to spiral out in certain directions when there is help available. I've mentioned this sometimes in my work with the claims division. It was very sad and touching as the World War II veterans became full retirement age, and they would be in their 70s and older. I would work with scores of them working on initial claims for post-traumatic stress disorder. They've gone through their lives working, being very much caught up in their day-to-day, life. And when finally they come to the, towards the end of their lives, now these problems were surfacing. And, so one of the things I think that the General and I have talked about is, are there ways to short-circuit that? Because as he pointed out, combat stress is normal. You have to be abnormal not to be stressed during combat. But it doesn't have to spiral into post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's, you know, what we would like to try to do with this, with these initiatives.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Paz?
Thank you. Excuse me, Representative Dempsey, for stepping on your turn there. Stearns County does have a special program of having a person, well, actually, Stearns County has a social worker that goes onto the street. But coming from the VA is a social worker also going onto the street to join her in that effort.
Steve Eisenreich.
Yeah, very correct. And they have taken what I classified as shameful conditions to conditions that they should brag about. We at one time had 155 people that were on the street not taking advantages of services. Many of those were veterans. They had reached a point where they had to be reached by an individual, almost a religious mission of going into that area. Many of the programs that we have are not taken advantage of by homeless veterans. When we did stand down, I actually went down to one of the neighboring camps and rattled on their cardboard box and asked if they were veterans, and if they were veterans, did they know about stand down? And I loaded them up in the car and took them out to stand down. And from there, they have moved on to better things. And so I think that type of program is very beneficial, and I would be very supportive of any action that recreates that in other areas. We are a central region, and so we have some areas that happens to us that probably doesn't happen in other places. We also, in Stearns County, we're in a tri-county area. So if our people are not cooperating, the veteran gets very confused at where to go. In Stearns County, obviously, in St. Cloud, is the easiest place to go, and the other two are far away from that service. So any actions that can be taken to make it under one roof, which I call borderless government, to receive that service under one roof, certainly in the tri-county area, but that service should be received under any roof in the 87 counties that we have in Minnesota. So I would encourage people to apply your wisdom and strength to those types of programs because they are working. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Deerwood. I want to commend you for your attention to the veteran service officers in the county. I know in our county they do just an amazing job of reaching out to some really difficult to serve populations, and their special outreach program, I think, has already proven its value, and I'm really delighted because I think so often the veterans that pay the highest price, other than those who give up their life, obviously that's the ultimate, are the ones whose life pirouettes into instability the rest of their adult life.
Right.
And we have so many of them who wander our city streets or in St. Cloud, as the former representative just commented, who just seem to never be able to get their feet under them in civilian life. And, you know, whether that happens immediately upon their return or in a midlife crisis, I mean, I think we need to be there. And one of the things that I have found in working with our veteran service officers is they have really done some outreach work that I don't think I typically would associate, which is a lot of our people who are having health problems later in life in their 50s or 60s don't associate that with their exposure to Agent Orange or other experiences in their Vietnam service and don't even think that that might be a service-related condition. And I'm hoping that you'll do some special outreach to the medical community because so many chronic health conditions have actually been certified now as military-related that no one would have thought about. I think people typically think of, you know, the people who have, you know, back problems because of a big fall that they took there or somebody who, you know, lost a limb. But a lot of people don't realize how many just ongoing chronic health conditions that they're experiencing later life may be service-related, and would encourage you in your outreach efforts to really emphasize that because I think a lot of people particularly are struggling with the health costs and medication costs, so that those kind of chronic conditions who could be helped tremendously.
Action Chair Seibert, Representative Westwick. I didn't really talk about that when we talked about outreach, but that actually, when we hook people up with their benefits, part of that is we hook them into the hospital system as well. But what the figures we have are the actual income generating, like compensation, pension, things of that nature. But that's obviously very, very important, is to get them medical attention. We're very much involved with that. And you did speak very eloquently about the role of county service officers. And I think what was really amazing to me, I was a county service officer in Thief River Falls, and once I got, that's where I grew up, and once I got the job and got behind, I mean, this is not a problem, just in the metro area. We didn't have words like PTSD at that time, but once we got behind the doors of some of the houses and saw what was going on, it was a real shock to me. So there are problems in every single county, no matter how large or small. And at that time, there's still World War I veterans around. And to see some of those were still suffering, but you never saw, I mean, they weren't homeless. We weren't a large enough community to have, homeless like that. But they were living these, what's that line, lives of quiet desperation behind these little houses, you know, all throughout the county. And so, I mean, there are real problems, and that's what we are trying to affect. We also sent out, a couple of years ago, we sent out letters to, we had a database based on the agent Vietnam veteran bonus. We had addresses, we got updated addresses, and sent out letters saying that if they're experiencing difficulties with Hep C or diabetes, that could be related to Agent Orange exposure. And numbers skyrocketed. People came in, they got simple blood tests to find out, because Hep C is very quiet, it's a quiet killer. And a lot of people discovered they had Hep C. A lot of people found out they were eligible for benefits that they never even considered. But that's exactly what we, and that piggybacks with Representative Dempsey's point. I mean, we are trying to get the word out. And I say we are so small, and we've been so quiet, and we are trying to expand in that area. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add to that, too, members, education is the key, and Representative Dempsey, I agree with you. We have to educate the veterans and make sure they're aware of what they're entitled to and what is going to benefit them, and that's really what the basis is of a lot of these initiatives, and that's why we do the DMOBs, working closely with military affairs, to make sure that they know what's out there for them. And the letters that the Commissioner was just talking about, that's an ongoing project. There are always different changes with regards to VA regulations and laws and presumptive conditions, and there are many that are being added and have been added with regards to exposure to Agent Orange. So whenever there's something new that comes out, we do our best to send a letter out to all the veterans we can contact, and we do have a pretty extensive database of veterans, letting them know, hey, there's a new benefit out there for you. Make sure you go to your CVSO, talk about it, get into the VA Medical Center, get tested for it. So education is the key. If they don't know what's available to them and what how they can be helped, then it's of no use to them, all these benefits. So that's really what we're focusing on, trying to get out there to reach them. Once we get them in, we do a good job. Our CVSOs do a great job of helping them. It's finding them, bringing them in, educating them, and empowering them. So that's the key.
I would be, Action Chair, I would be remiss if I did not thank you and Representative Severson and several other members of the committee that have continued to work on veterans issues last year, through the summer, into this year. I cannot thank you enough for your efforts in that regard. I'd also just like to mention Jim Cleary is here today, and obviously he's, all of you know the work he's done over the years, but I was very privileged to be at Monticello Armory last summer, or whenever it was, where the Iraq license plates were presented to the first unit, of which his son happened to be a member of, and had actually given email testimony during the last session. And it was a very moving experience, and I know Mr. Cleary was there, and I think he's very proud of both the work he had done and to see his son get one of those first plates along with the rest of the unit. It was a very moving experience, so I'd just like to draw that to your attention.
Well, I appreciate the nice comments, and
this is Mr. Craig. I try to get it through to my colleagues that, that staff don't like to be recognized, so I owe him one. And I'll find a good chance to get it. But thank you. I know it's well.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate, Commissioner, I appreciate the nice comments, and you know, you've thanked us several times, but as we require our soldiers to do certain things, this is our duty, and we have a duty to them as they have a duty to our country, so it's all in the name of duty, and I think I speak for all of my comrades. So, any other questions? Okay, thank you, Commissioner Dyrud, Commissioner Pugliese.
Thank you.
Chair Teal said we'll resume the chair.
Okay, members, we're on item 5 here on the agenda, and Representative Severson is going to give a brief overview of some of the governor's military initiatives, kind of piggybacks on the information we've been talking about the last few minutes. And then after that, we'll have the Department of Administration up. I see them waiting in the audience, so we'll have an overview with the task force group that worked with the Ford building and other issues. So with that, Vice Chair Severson, can you tell us about the bill that you'll be presenting during session this year?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I want to just say I'll be quick about this. I think it's been covered significantly. But I do want to say that leadership sets the tone. And I think General Shillito has done quite well in terms of illustrating to us that we have a top-notch military in Minnesota, and that's because of his leadership and those that he has put in position to make a choice, as well as the Veteran Affairs Committee with Commissioner Dyrud, and they have been tireless in their efforts to get that information out to the veterans to try and find out. And that's what really leads us up to this point today, where the governor has put together a tremendous initiative in this bill. And Commissioner Dyrud went through a good portion of it, but I just want to quickly touch on some of the items that I think are very relevant to this committee, and that's the retired pay initiative. You know, this has been something that has been kind of tossed back and forth for probably the last 10 years, and we've really not had the means to make it happen, and I think we've looked at it from a wrong perspective here. One of the things that's coming up and looming in the 2010 is a workforce issue. Talented workforce that we are going to be in severe deficits for if we don't take some action now. And one of the ways to look at it is, say, higher education needs to get on board and start programming towards that. But I think even a more significant way to approach this is to say, you know what, we have a tremendous asset that we are not tapping out there. One of the commissioners at this veterans meeting I had this last week came up to me and he said, you know, my son is retiring from the military, and he looked at Minnesota and he saw that military retiree pay was being taxed, and he said, I'm not coming there. That's one just in this last week. And if you take a look at the numbers in Minnesota, currently out of the 295 million people in the United States, 1.9 million retirees, Minnesota has 16,000. Proportionally, we should have 33,000 military retirees in the state. We have 16, less, just about half of what we should have. And it's not because Minnesota isn't a great place to live, because people want to raise their families in the environment that Minnesota has. They want to bring it to a place where there are economic opportunities. The bioscience is that burgeoning economic opportunity for Minnesota, and that's where we need to begin to actively recruit the talent. Now, the talent comes in terms of you know, doctors, lawyers. It's a subculture the military is. These are people that have been working hard for 20, 30 years, have leadership opportunities that rival the corporate sector, and in many places exceed the corporate sector responsibilities for multi-million dollars, if not billion-dollar budgets. And we're saying to these people, if you come to Minnesota, we're going to tax your retirement, and there are 30, almost 40, 42 other states that don't do that. And for those people, it's a business decision. Can I go to that state? Can I make a decent living besides what I'm getting from my retirement pay? And can I have an impact on the community? Those are the people that we want to bring here. So that's just a kind of a short, hard-hitting on the whole issue with the retired pay pension exemption. And I think we are, as was said earlier, penny-wise, pound-foolish if we don't grab onto this. There are California, Wisconsin, Florida, Maryland, all of these states, other states, are actively going after the retired forces because they understand, you know, a classic example is the nurse shortage. We spent $10 million in educating nurses for the shortage that we have in Minnesota in a bonding bill 2 years ago, I think it was. And if we can get those that are retiring out of the Navy to come directly in, we save a ton of money on not just educating them, but on experience level. A couple of the other things that weren't touched on, I think that what is in the governor's bill is the Military Veterans Support Cabinet. And this is a great concept because we have tremendous leaders. And let me just put in kind of a public service announcement for the military working group that we've had. And we have had people just continuing, as they've heard about this, they've continued to come, and they have continued to enlarge the area of expertise and the area of which we have influence over. And to Representative Demmer's point, he was not here. Yesterday we had a small meeting that addressed the very issue of veterans coming back who are business owners and not having the assets in their businesses dissolved. And there is a state and federal program that has monies directly allotted for that purpose. And nobody knew about it. We had an SBA member come yesterday who said, here's the program, and we tied through deed, we tied those two together. So those issues are being addressed even as we speak. Okay. That website that we're talking about, putting together through the Veterans Administration, is going to be a comprehensive website that hopefully even in the pre-deployment briefing, our soldiers and sailors will be able to go to and say, if I'm a small business owner and I go to this website, here's a spot that says, for small business owners who are deploying. They click onto that, and then it gives them the means, whether it's voluntary through some other service groups or some other sources, it gives them a list of what they can do to preempt losing their business while they're deployed. So there's kind of a multifaceted on this. Getting back to the Military Veteran Support Cabinet, a lot of the issues that we are brought up, we have a hard time, other than taking care of it legislatively, which is kind of a heavy hand in a lot of these things. We can take care of it through this cabinet. Refer to the cabinet. Those people have the means and the knowledge and the authority in that particular cabinet to make it happen at a lower level. So this is a good fix, and it's very visionary for the whole proposal that the governor has here. One of the other things I wanted to hit on very quickly is the higher ed proposals to create veteran assistance advisors at all Minsky campuses. Some of the things we've experienced is our veterans are coming back, they're going to campus, and they're coming out of a pretty harried situation where they've been overseas deployed, and all of a sudden they get thrown into the campus structure. They don't know what their benefits are from the state through the federal government through that program, and there's no one there to help them. Where do they go? So they go to the student union, and there isn't a representative there to tell them what their benefits are. And so a lot of times what happens is they get frustrated after one or two semesters. They're out of there. They go someplace else. Again, these are tremendous assets that we need to take through the educational system and put them with job skills into the marketplace. The other portion is educational benefits transfer. You know, when they go through the military, they take numerous courses, and some of them are 3 to 4 weeks long and very intense that give them a lot of the things that we teach them at our college and universities, and we are not giving them credit for them. We're making them take it again. So this is another initiative to make sure that the courses that they've taken are documented while they're in the military. They get credited for when they go to that campus, and they don't have to take that course or pay for it again. Another great one is, we have military people coming in from outstate. They like Minnesota. They want to go to our universities. And they want to live in Minnesota. Well, the first thing we do to them is say, you're going to have to pay out state tuition. And yet we have foreign people from foreign countries come in, and we have a program to give them in-state tuition. So if you want to grind on a warrior, tell them that we're giving that person who lives in another country in-state tuition, but you have to pay out-state tuition. And these are just some of the things that have come to our attention during the committee. And these are things that we're making right in this bill. And I'm going to back off and just say when we present the bill, we will be
open for any amendments that come forward and an open discussion, but I believe that the bill as we have it here is a strong bill for veterans and for military affairs that takes care of our warriors as they're coming back, and it has a vision for how we can recruit those who may think about going to another state, but we want you in Minnesota. Any questions from you, Madam Chair?
Representative Seibert.
Don't have a question, but a comment. There's a timing issue involved here as well. I mentioned earlier that there's going to be a drawdown from the Air Force between 30 and 57,000 people. I don't know what the Army's doing or the Navy or anything like that, but the last time we had a drawdown, they offered a reduced 15-year retirement. And so we're going to have more retirees at 15 years. And these are mid-level NCOs. These people are trained and ready to move on to the next level. And we need to draw those people into the state. I think it's imperative. And all the things that Representative Severson said, we have those things in place by that time. We're going to get a lot of talent, and it's going to alleviate a lot of problems. So I ask you to support this.
And Madam Chair, just a kind of a follow-up, if I could, to that. If you take a look at the retiree numbers, the 16,000, basically, the older numbers, and I'll just use those because I'm familiar with them, 16,000 brought to the state about $221 million in terms of retirement benefits. Now, that they also bring with them tax-free, or not tax-free, but health care, federal-funded health care. So they are not a load on the system. They paid to the state about $17 to $18 million. Now, those numbers are going up. If we were to recruit, again, what proportional amount of people that we should have, retirees from the military force, we're talking about 33,000. We're talking probably in the terms of $500 million of revenue coming into this state. And that is more than going to make up for the $19 million that is phased in over 4 years. By the time, if we were doing this correctly, by the time we hit that fourth-year mark, we should have exceeded the income through other means in that $19 million and probably doubled it. So that's just my pitch for that.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Severson, one of the things that I'm really interested in is the credit transfer for education. I have too many examples to name off today about childhood friends or business associates in which have great training, but come back into the state and wanting to go into the workforce aren't being recognized for the training that they had. How well do you think we'll be able to get this implemented? I mean, it seems kind of administratively heavy, but something that definitely needs to be done. I mean, what's the plan for accomplishing the goal?
Yeah.
Representative Hosh.
Madam Chair and Representative Hosh, that's a good question, and part of this is the putting the veterans on campus. I think the commissioner alluded a little bit to that, too. Because there are, on a lot of campuses, there are no advocates for veterans. And so if we have someone either in a part-time or full-time job there who is an advocate for the veterans on campus, they can go down to the administrative, because a lot of this is partially in place. There is the infrastructure to make that happen, but there aren't the people to hold the institutions accountable. And that's where the position is for the veteran, and I'll say it's kind of a veteran service officer on campus, basically, who makes sure that he's, number one, his poster is around, his or her poster is around there to say, if you're a veteran, come see me. And then they, in turn, go to the administration building and say, okay, here's his DD-214. This says all of the classes that he has taken. And there's another manual, federal manual, that says this is what it qualifies for in terms of civilian employment. And so that there's a direct correlation there. And that's a process we're going to have to walk through a few times until it gets comfortable. But it's, you know, it's worthy of the effort.
Okay, next up, Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Severson, one thing I was going to mention is that at Southwest Minnesota State, we already have a veteran center. We just opened it a couple weeks ago, and the person that staffs it is half-time Lyon County Veteran Service Officer, and then he also teaches a couple classes at Southwest in English because he has a master's degree. And then he's staffing the office himself and then a work-study student. And I tell you, we've had tremendous success, and a lot of veterans that are intimidated at going and asking, you know, other people about things, but, you know, very knowledgeable about the GI Bill, the benefits that they get, questions about everything under the sun. And if we wanted to have him come up and testify when you formally present your bill, he said he'd be happy to do that and talk about some of the things that we've already started doing. They've tried to get kind of funding from all sorts of different things. The college is helping. We have an open office that we're doing. The county I'm not sure who else is helping pay for it, but you know, they're basically putting everything together. But you know, I think for the sizable colleges, our size or bigger, I think there's a big need for it, and I'm glad that you've got this as part of the bill. The other thing on the credit transfer, you know, I work at the university in admissions, and I tell you, there are some big frustrations. You know, one example the other day that I had, and I met with one of the veterans that came back from Iraq, at most of the liberal arts colleges, there's a requirement for, you know, ours is called Wellness and Human Performance, which is a fancy name for Phi-Ed, and it's a one-credit activity requirement. Now, you have veterans coming back that went through basic training, strength training, you know, basically gutted themselves out working on these different fitness and training things, and they're coming back and they're getting denied the one credit of Wellness and Human Performance, and they get to take Walking for Wellness because they're not allowed to bring in the basic training credits. And I just am beyond outraged when I hear stuff like that. Yeah. And a lot of it is just, you know, we can talk about committees at the U of M and Minsku and all that stuff. The bottom line is put it in law and it's going to happen. And exercise common sense. But, you know, I don't know if the positions that you're talking about are going to have the beef enough to do the credit thing. I think there is a standardized transfer that the governor's talked about across the country that can be brought in. But there's some real common sense ones, I think Larry alluded to, of, you know, probably some of the same stuff I've heard that just do not make sense. And sometimes maybe they don't equate three credits for three credits, but in that situation, their one credit is more than made up, in my opinion, and the things that they're required to do. My dad was in Korea, and you know, you were in the military. The things that you do in the military, I think, are above and beyond what anybody would do in Walking for Wellness class. So that's probably the one that I think is one of the best ones in here.
Awesome. Madam Chair and Representative Cypress. Yeah, I fully anticipate that if you can have your gentleman come down and testify, that'd be awesome, and we may use that as a model. At this point, we are, you know, formulating. These are the general concepts we need to formulate how we actually administer it. And if you're talking about post-traumatic stress, talk about going onto a campus where you're, you know, you have just come out of a life-and-death situation, and you've been, you know, you've had a lot of responsibility, and you walk up to somebody and do exactly what you're talking about, say, I've been doing this, and they say, well, that doesn't count. And immediately you just feel demeaned. You just feel like, well, nobody understands me, and it just kind of piles on. So I think this part of the initiative is a very valuable, and it's something that we, you know, it's due.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. We look forward to that legislation. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next up is Department of Administration. Thank you for your patience. I see Commissioner Badgero in the audience. I see Jim Rhodes is going to be presenting today on the Ford Building and other things.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Former
Representative Jim Rhodes, chair of this committee, welcome back to your former committee here, now as in your role as Department of Administration.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. There should be a handout that everybody have in their packet.
Ford Building?
Yep. Do you have a spare one so I can just refer to it? Members, if you recall, we had legislation last year to talk about the future of the Ford Building. There was all kinds of ideas that people were nervous about and not nervous about, but it's created enough of an issue that they thought legislatively we should take a look at it. And legislation formed a working group to sit down and try to figure out what can be done with the future of the Ford Building. And the future of the Ford Building, which is the one on University Avenue for those that may not recognize it, has quite a bit of a history, and we wanted to incorporate that into it, but we didn't want to go with a set agenda that we were going to, that people would walk in on the first day of the committee and fear, oh, they already know what they're going to do at the end. And really nobody did know how it was going to take place. We had several members of not only legislators and staff, but also we had members of the community from Christ Lutheran Church, the neighbor next door, to the historical people on University Avenue. We had quite a group, including also professionals and nonprofit people, to talk about what is the future of the Ford Building. The Ford Building, as many of you may now know now as you read the report, started out Henry Ford, much like Target, by the way, had designed these buildings all over the country, and you will find that there's approximately over 20 of them. They all look the same, much like the targets do, whether it's a left or right or how they work it into the land. The same situation is with the Ford building. And they actually did put together cars there. And very interestingly enough, there are pictures in the brochure that show the cars sitting there in the basement and all, and there's also a heavy-duty elevator where they used to assemble them. When they went into the mass production assembly line, the building became obsolete for that and wound up as a retail space for cars and then continued on through the years. If you go in the building, some of you have, you'll find on the pillars the F, the Ford F, their logo F, on the pillars today. So with that in mind, we wanted to be very respectful of the history and what the future should be with the building. From that, we had several meetings through the year, and we started to build a consensus of where we wanted to go. Now, there are some constraints that we should know about going in the door. One is it was bonded with state money, state bonding money, which also has issues dealing with what you can do and what you can't do with the building. You cannot lease out a building, per se, 100% because it doesn't work that way because it's state-bonded money. The same side of the coin, you cannot also deal with issues of usages for surplus. So if we declare it surplus, we have to go through a process and it is then auctioned off to the highest bidder. If nobody wants it, then it could be actually torn down or declared that they use it for something else. All these constraints were discussed in depth, and with that we came out with some of the recommendations that we brought forth in the report. The first and foremost is that the committee felt they did not want to tear the building down. So the building is not going to be torn down, number one. Number two, they felt that they would like to perhaps use it for some kind of future use but keep it mothballed, which it is being done now. So we are spending approximately $25,000 a year to keep the building as it is. There is no heat in the building. There is no water running in the building. It is just a structure. There is some fencing on the outside to keep some of the outside areas from coming down. And we did have a problem with the loose bricks out in front. They were taken off, and they are stored in the building. They were not disposed of. So they can be replaced if they have to be replaced, depending on how the usage would go. We talked about, Representative Leffer had an idea about a one-stop shop on the main floor. We got a perfect retail area. We could do all kinds of things. People could walk in and have e-government, could have, I don't want to steal your thunder, but, you know, we could have one-stop shop for licenses, for car licenses, for hunting licenses, for connecting up with other people. Within government, we could have a retail space there of selling things. We could even have a coffee shop there. We could do certain little percentages for that type of thing. That would probably be very accommodating. The key factor in this building is it's connected in the tunnel. And the reason why I bring that up is because one of the driving forces that we talked about was its location in respect to the Capitol. As we started talking, we came across the idea that there is going to be, through the Friends of the Capitol, a request for money for bonding to help restore the Capitol and the infrastructure of the Capitol on a major scale. If that is done, they are going to have to relocate offices from people that are now officing in the Capitol, including senators. Now, stop and think about this now. If we're going to relocate them, while the building is being worked on, and the plan is over a period of number of years because they want to do it every bonding cycle rather than doing it all at once, although at this point anything's up for grabs. The key is, where would these folks relocate? And we talked about utilizing the Ford building in that way. We could, if they decide to revamp the Capitol, there could be an allocation come through to restore the building and then utilize that space for relocation of the people that are housed now in each wing of the Capitol at a time. They would be in the tunnel complex. They would be very easily located, obviously just across the street, and it would be a very beneficial use. If that would work, and the idea is formulated through the committee process, if this would work, then what you could do is have a continuous operation of the building for future use later on, which could be the one-stop shop. It could house different boards and agencies for offices, that type of thing, and the building would already be up and running. So that is kind of where we were as we started to walk through. We wanted to keep in mind the history of the building. We wanted to keep in mind the neighbors and the neighborhood. The neighbors would love to have some type of usage of the building. There's no question about it. And we kept in mind the tunnel and then the relocation if that would be necessary. And with that, I'm going to stop and maybe answer some questions for you as to where we are and how we got there.
Okay, I have a couple members on the list, but first I wanted to point out in the back of the booklet here, it does list off several legislators who were working group members. The ones that are on our committee are Representative Sheldon Johnson, Representative Phyllis Kahn, Representative Diane Loeffler, Representative Mark Olson, Representative Neil Peterson, and Representative Marty Seifert.
And I should, when you mentioned Representative Kahn, her famous quote, if she was here today, would tell you that not one of the four buildings has been torn down yet.
You don't want to speak first. That's Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually was not on the task force in terms of attending meetings. I did have, I don't know if Representative Blaine's name is on here. So, there
yes.
It is.
Oh, yes.
Representative Blaine and Kahn were the two designees from my committee on state government finance that were supposed to give their input on things and so forth. One question I had in the interim, Jim, is how many parking slots are behind that building and what are they being used for? Are they, you know, one of the big problems a lot of the public has is I come to testify, where do I, you know, especially rural Minnesota, they drive around, there's nowhere to go. The meter, they have to, you know, they come testify, then they tell us, well, we got to run, throw three quarters in the thing out by the DOT. You know, would we be able to, in an interim situation, be able to utilize those parking slots? How many are there, and what are they being used for now?
If memory, thank you, Representative Seifert, Madam Chair, Representative Seifert, members. If memory serves me correct, there's about 20-some spots, and they are being utilized right now. We have not, any parking stall is being used. At, when they were, we actually, in, when they were building the new buildings, we used some of those out. They're for pay, because people pay to park there. So they are being used now also by state employees.
Okay. So they're utilized.
They are utilized.
Okay. Other questions for members? Representative Loeffler, I know you were active in this. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think former Representative Rodney deserves a lot of credit for having worked on a very pretty intense process over a short period of time. And one of the things that I want to share, though, is how much the community was engaged in this. Not only do we have 15 legislators engaged, we also had a lot of experts on architects and architecture and historical preservation, but we also had very active participation from representatives of the community, both people who live in the neighborhood as well as the church that's next door. And one of our conclusions was not just about the future of the building and the reuse of it, but was also about our current level of maintenance, because if you've looked over there, we don't really do our state proud in terms of how we've maintained the grounds around there, and I think we do need to kind of put our best foot forward to the public, even when we've got something that's sort of just in limbo in terms of maintenance and weed control and some of those sorts of things. The other thing that I think was clear was that people just really, of the members of the public who really participated, they really want to see us treasuring and preserving our historical buildings, and they really think that that's a commitment and a gift to their community. And one of the ideas that I had thrown out that the committee has put into its final report is that we start to look at, as we set our rent levels for state operations, whether it's in this building or elsewhere, that when we have historic old buildings that have unique costs related to that historic preservation, that the cost of dealing with that, the additional cost of that, not be folded into the rent but maybe be appropriated separately. Because we make these buildings uncompetitive when state agencies have complete freedom, I was surprised to learn, to really decide wherever they want to locate. And so if they can say, well, gee, it'd be closer to my home if I rented in this new office building over here or this other office building, they can choose that rather than a building that we have, the taxpayers have paid for through bonding, who have maintained for a long period of time, and whose neighbors see as a real investment, a long-term investment by the state. And so one of the things that I'll be bringing forward legislation with the other people on the committee is to look at establishing a policy by which we can preserve our historic structures without making them economically obsolete. Because right now we have a system that really puts them at a competitive disadvantage, and that's part of why this building is currently empty, is because when the printing operation that was in the basement, the state decided to go out to bid for private contracting of printing rather than running its own printing shop. And as you can imagine, there wasn't a whole lot of state agencies who felt that it would be really lovely to be in a windowless basement with high ceilings and using the back half of the loading dock. And when that rent wasn't available for that building, then the rent went up on the remaining tenants, and they flew as fast as they could. Some of you may remember that the state bookstore used to be on the first floor. They're a very visible location. I mean, people would stop there and pick up, you know, bike trail maps, some of the wonderful publications that come out of DNR. You know, people who deal with governmental agencies could run and pick up a copy of the rules. You know, those sorts of things. And, you know, they've gone to a place that I don't think, you know, hardly anybody can find now that we're trying to reach and access governmental services. And so I think, you know, there's some interesting policy learnings that came out of this in addition to us wanting to preserve a place that's a place of part of history but also will solve a problem with the state capitol reconstruction.
Good point. Madam Chair, I think the key is the neighborhood had a feel for being also participating big time in this group, and it was a nice thing when we would send out emails back and forth, especially towards the end, about how do you feel about this final report. And we got back, everything looks good, so can we make this change and that change? And it was a very cohesive, neat, I guess the word neat, it was a neat group of people that got together and came out very positively about how they felt about it. And the final report, there was no dissension at all. It was that positive.
Thank you. Well, we'll be looking forward to legislation on that. As you know, we only have 8 to 10 meetings in March before the first deadline, so you know, get those bills introduced early.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting us present this. And now you asked for Kathy Sybil to come down. She's going to talk about the licensing part of the DRIVE program to bring you up to date. Thank you very much.
Ms. Sybil, thank you for coming to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and as well as your colleagues.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Sybil, and I'm the Program Director for the Drive to Excellence program. This morning I'm going to give you a little refresher on Drive to Excellence, a little bit of an update on where we're at, and then Mary Beth Stoltz is going to give you an explanation of the License Minnesota program. And there is a handout that is being passed out right now. The mission of Drive to Excellence is to enable the effective, efficient, and economic delivery of state government services. Now, if you remember, the three driving factors for Drive to Excellence are, first, that citizens are demanding better services of us. Secondly, we're all under continuing budgetary pressures. And then third is that the fact that there are large number of our workforce is going to be retiring in the near future. And I know a number of other speakers this morning alluded to that fact. And the statistic is that within the next 10 years, 47% of all government workers will be retiring. So the baby boomer generation is reaching retirement age. So those are the three driving factors of the Drive to Excellence program. And to overcome those challenges, last April, the governor approved the Drive to Excellence Transformation Roadmap, and along with that approval, he started six different projects. And the six different projects are, and I'll name those for you and explain what they are. First is a grants management project, and the purpose of that is to create an enterprise structure for managing the $1.1 billion of grants that we have coming into the state every year. The second project is the constructions code consolidation, and that is taking five business units that were located at different separate buildings within the state complex and putting them under one roof so that there is a one-stop place for citizens to go to get information about business units, business code units. The real property project is also about creating an enterprise structure for how we manage the 5,000 buildings that we have within the state and then also the 6 million acres of land. That would be creating an enterprise system and a governance system. Purchasing project is all about re-engineering how we do purchasing here at the state. It's basically looking at strategic sourcing all of our contracts so that we have deeper discounts. The IT governance project is to create IT services that enable agencies to have the best use of technology here within the state. And then the sixth and, of course, not last project is the licensing project. This morning I think you heard the term one-stop shop quite a few times. And here again, what we're trying to do with the licensing project is to create a one-stop online shop so that citizens can go to one place to get licensed, either the license itself or license information anytime, even at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that way they would be self-serving to get the information that they need. In December, December 15th, we provided the first annual report to the governor on the Drive to Excellence. And within it, we talked about a number of accomplishments that we've made to date. One of the big accomplishments is creating standards and new pricing for IT equipment. Now, this is quite groundbreaking because this is the first time in history that all the agencies have agreed to standards for their laptops, for their desktop PCs, and for monitors. They negotiated new pricing, and the pricing discounts are up to 44% better than the previous contracts. So we're looking at the very, very deep discounts. And the discounts look so beneficial that not only are the state agencies starting to use these new contracts, but also MINSCU, as well as local cities and counties and the school boards. So the more volume we get, of course, the more discounts, the more savings we have. Another accomplishment is that we amended the office supplies contract. We took a catalog of about 25,000 items, reduced it down to 3,000, and went a step farther. We took that catalog and made it online, so we even reduced the printing. That was effective January 1st. And then the third item that we liked it out is that we created a Licensed Minnesota website. And with that, your handout does include the press release that came out about Licensed Minnesota. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mary Beth to explain a little bit more about that website.
So it's, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Beth Stoltz, and I'm the Information Systems Manager for the Department of Labor and Industry, as well as the Project Manager for the Drive to Excellence One-Stop Licensing and Third-Party Examinations Initiative. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I've never done this before, so please give me a little credit here. As Kathy alluded to, we've heard a few messages about one-stop shop licensing, and what we've done is we've unveiled this new website that gives citizens an opportunity to go to one place to get information on licenses for businesses, professional occupations, vehicle and recreational licenses. The benefits of putting this together are to save time and money for the citizens. There are close to 700 different licenses that the state of Minnesota administers, and these are administered throughout 40 different licensing agencies and boards. And so we've collected this information and put it together so that citizens can get information that they want on licenses in one place, and they can get it at any time that they're needing to have this information. And it reduces calls to the state of Minnesota for assistance. It's easy to find. We've put this on the state's homepage, which is also known as North Star, and there's a banner that's called Licensed Minnesota, and you click on that, and citizens no longer have to guess where they have to go to get this information that they're looking for. And it's easy to use. We've provided different opportunities for them. They can search by department, license activity, or the license name. They can even provide a keyword if they want to be a frog farmer and they don't know where to go. Is that agriculture? Is that DNR? They can key in frogs and up will pop information related to all the fraud-type licenses in Minnesota. From there, people can go and obtain additional information that has statutory references to the licenses, to who is the regulating agency for that, contact information, fee information, exam information, etc. Since we launched this 2 months ago, we've had over 24,000 visits to our site. We're averaging about 400 visits a day. And we've been discovering a trend that each month people are staying at our site longer, so we think that means that they're using the site for information to obtain what they need to do. What's neat about this is that this was a collaborative effort between the licensing project work group members, which was composed of people from labor and industry, the DNR, health, human services, etc., in addition to the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Office of Enterprise Technology. And these people worked together to put this site together in a relatively short time frame, and it's really exciting that it's, we find it easy to use, and we've been hearing some good positive things about it. What's next? We're going to continually add and update information. We are creating a web enhancement plan that will make this even easier for citizens to use. We are looking at ways that we can coordinate with other entities to add information, such as Minsky's iSeek, which has a tool that is used for a career development tool for people who are going into positions that may require licensure, so that we're hooking up with them. And eventually we're going to be incorporating into an actual online enterprise system. We recognize that not everybody has access to the Internet, so we will be providing methods of obtaining information outside of the Internet. For contact information, we have the Drive to Excellence website. We have the License Minnesota website. And I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions.
Thank you. First up, Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has there been any discussion on the governor's part or admin's part on, you know, and this is a little different than making it more efficient to get a license. What my question is why we have so many licenses. Why do we have all these frog licenses and so forth? And I know we have a lot of special interests that come in, and to legitimize whatever they're doing, ask for us to license whatever they're doing. And I've seen my share of bills come and go, and get some get voted down and some passed. But has there ever been analysis, like as compared to Wisconsin, how many licenses do we have versus some of these other states? I'm kind of wondering if some of them might have 400 to 500 licenses instead of, you know, 600 to 800 licenses like we have. And I know that's a very broad question, but has there been thoughts in the administration or in the admin department about consolidating licenses and just getting rid of some licenses, and potentially we don't need to have a website with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them if we can kind of at least consolidate them down and at least get rid of a few dozen of them or something? What do you think of that? Has there been any thoughts on that yet, or...
Who wants to take that hot potato? Ms. Stoltz?
There's no wrong answer either.
Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, actually there has been Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, actually there has been discussion about that. One of the next steps that we're moving into is kind of a business process mapping, reengineering, rationalization. Do we need all of these licenses? The Department of Agriculture went through an exercise where they reduced their licensing from like 85 down to 55, and we want to do that as part of our process with this project.
So, and they need a bill to do that, right? The ag bill, or somebody has to, I'm assuming most of those are statutory.
I would imagine so, yes.
Okay, very good, thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because the average Joe out there kind of wonders sometimes, you know, why aren't we consolidating or simplifying some of these rather than just making it easier to get a license maybe we shouldn't even have. So I appreciate that.
Except for Sam Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to kind of go off of Representative Seifert's question, and I don't want to go the opposite direction, but I mean, some of the licensing seems to be excessive in certain areas. One of the things that I've been frustrated with is it appears that you have to get a license to do frog farming, but at the same time, our child protection workers don't need to be licensed at all dealing with child abuse, and you see the horror stories throughout the nation with some of these issues. Is there also going to be an effort to say, you know, that there are some legitimate areas where we don't currently license that you may want to consider in the future, too?
Ms. Stoltz?
Madam Chair and Representative Hosh. Thank you. Yes, that will be a part of our plan, that we'll need to look at that. I agree.
Okay, next up, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I think it's great that we're kind of making things much more accessible and understandable, but one of my pet peeves, and I'm hoping you're addressing it as you do all this important website work, is to also provide phone number contacts for people, because in my district, and I'm sure in everybody's district, there's lots and lots of people who don't have access to the internet except through the library or through borrowing a friend's access. They don't have email accounts, and so when you give an email address to contact someone for further information, it really sort of stops the dialogue, and I'm hoping that state agency phone numbers will be prominent on all of your work as you continue to enhance the web as a tool for us reaching out to citizens.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Hoppe.
This average Joe will pass.
Okay, Joe Hoppe. Anything else from members? Okay, thank you for your presentation. Appreciate your hard work in this area.
Thank you.
Okay, and I believe that's it from Department of Admin, correct? All right, thank you for coming in today, and thank you for your patience. Okay, members, before we adjourn, I just have two quick announcements. The blue forms that you have, please get those turned in before you leave. And then also, you might want to grab the agenda and bring it to your LA, because it has the information on the bottom here for March 1st and March 2nd, when we'll be meeting. That'll also be listed on the website. So with that, members, meeting adjourned. Thank you.